Okay, so thanks a lot. Very glad to be here. I'm also very glad with the tradition here in Perimeter to give Blackboard talks, then you don't have to prepare slides. Today I would like to talk about something that might be of interest to several people here. That's why I chose this this title. So this is about matrix product operators, which is actually some tensor network for describing topological quantum order. And I know that there's many people doing tensor networks here. There's also many people doing working on topological quantum order. So I thought that this might be a good match. But actually, the main reason that I chose this topic is that one of my students is here for the next kind of 4 months, and I think this is a very good introduction on what he's working on. So basically, I'm reporting what my students, like Belting, Hageman, Marian, Sahinoglu, Shuch, Shuch is not a student, and Hageman also not, but anyway, so this is a collaboration. But especially Dominic Williamson, somehow I'm talking about the results that that he has also obtained, and I think if you're interested in this, sitting here, this is the guy to talk to. I'm also, I think it's very exciting. I think one of the goals of this whole community and tensor networks is indeed to see that actually many topics or many concepts that look very, very hard, both from the mathematical or from the conceptual kind of point of view, become much, much simpler if you think about it in the language of tensor networks. And I think, and I would like to kind of convey that message or convince you that certainly this is also the case for concepts like topological quantum order, where I personally kind of had a very great difficulty understand all these modular tensor categories and all this. This is all, for me, this is all way too abstract. But once you formulate it in terms of these tensor networks, all these kind of notions become kind of pretty clear and much more tangible. And that's what I would like to convince you about today. So the main topic or the main kind of building block that we will work on is something that is called PEPS. Okay, PEPS stands for projected entangled pair states, and this is I guess all of you are kind of familiar with matrix product states and tensor networks, so I don't have to probably give you too thorough of introduction to these notions. But somehow this is a kind of a two-dimensional version of a matrix product state. And so one of the big goals in condensed matter is basically to classify all possible phases of matter. And of course, somehow the person that is really pushing this program is Xiaogang Wen, who you all know, very well. And somehow the point of view is that somehow we have the set of kind of phases or quantum many body states that kind of correspond to ground states of local Hamiltonians. They lie on a very small dimensional manifold. Okay, and this is kind of obvious because the Hamiltonian, the number of parameters you have to parameterize local Hamiltonian is very, very small. Therefore, somehow, well, the manifold of ground states of such Hamiltonians should also be very small. And indeed, somehow, the amazing thing is that if you are interested in gapped phases, that somehow this manifold, somehow, well, that you can make statements about this manifold, and then it turns out to be very well represented by kind of tensor networks. And especially in one-dimensional systems, turns out that there's actually just this one manifold is just one nice big connected kind of thing. So all ground states of all possible gapped phases in one-dimensional quantum spin systems are basically connected to each other. So this is, well, this is actually a bit boring, and somehow that's why people actually invented that somehow other methods of distinguishing. And indeed, somehow in nature, somehow it happens that many transformations or many kind of symmetries are kind of pretty hardly encoded. And then it turned out, and this is this whole business of SPT phases, is that you kind of only allow for transformations that preserve a symmetry. That somehow that means that you take basically a cut through this manifold of possible ground states, and you only look at the ones that have a certain symmetry, then somehow these things fall into disconnected parts, and there's no way to go from one part to another one without basically breaking your symmetry. Okay, and this is exactly what SPT phases are about. Okay, this is symmetry protected topological phases, and somehow these phases have all been basically classified in one dimension by these matrix product states and this co-cycles and all these kind of things that Xiaogang Wen and many of his collaborators have worked on. But we are not concerned with this. We are concerned basically with the two-dimensional version. Okay, and in two-dimensional version, the two-dimensional physics is already much richer. Okay, so you don't have to impose symmetries for this manifold of ground states of local Hamiltonians to fall into kind of disconnected parts. Okay, so this manifold already kind of falls into disconnected parts. There's no way of going from one phase to another one because of the existence or the possibility of topological quantum order. Okay, and I would like to kind of, well, this is the topic that I would like to talk about. So there's manifold splits into different pieces, and somehow these different pieces are basically classified according to some kind of mathematical things. And I would like to kind of try to get some more insight in why is it, or how do you basically, not why, but somehow, how do you classify, or how are these properties or these different phases kind of manifested if you represent these states in terms of PEPs. So this, to imagine, this is somehow the manifold of all possible PEPs, all these projected entangled pair states. Let's say this is like the two-dimensional tensor network where you have a building block, just like a tensor with five legs. You have four virtual indices, one physical index, and you just put these things next to each other. And this way you kind of basically fill your whole lattice. And this is a description of a translation invariant kind of many-body state, somehow this defined basically by this local tensor. Okay, and somehow the main, the amazing thing of these tensor networks is that somehow, let me first say what the amazing thing is of these topological phases. The amazing thing of these topological phases is that you cannot distinguish them locally. Okay, so to basically see that somehow you're in a phase with topological order, you really must look at non-local order parameter. There's no local order parameter that distinguishes this phase from that phase. It's only kind of non-local order parameters. Okay, so the amazing thing in these kind of tensor network descriptions is that actually this non-local kind of description or these non-local order parameters are again reflected in the local properties of these tensors. Okay, so what you get is this one tensor. And it turns out that the symmetry, somehow the topological order is completely manifested by some symmetry of these tensors. Okay, so and indeed somehow a local symmetry of this tensor, there's no reason why you would see this in local observables, but it's kind of only manifested globally on your complete kind of state. And we would like to understand exactly this phenomenon. Okay, we would like to understand how do we quantify this? How do we kind of characterize the symmetry of such a state? Okay, so it turns out that these symmetries for the most kind of general kind of phases or bosonic phases of topological phases, so are all kind of represented by something else called matrix product operators. That's why this is in the title, and that's why somehow all the focus of this talk will be exactly on this matrix product operators. Okay, so so turns out that this kind of matrix product operators, that this is kind of, these symmetries are a generalization of some, this is a kind of, this fits into a long line of other work. Somehow the first ones to realize that actually the symmetries of these tensors kind of encode somehow, or the properties of topological order is again Xi Gang Wen. Then somehow this was followed up by some very nice paper of Shug, David Perez Garcia, and Ignacio Sirac, where they basically kind of looked at purely local symmetry. So where you have like this tensor is invariant under some kind of a group, U dagger. I will give some examples on that. So you apply somehow unitary transformations on these legs, and this tensor remains invariant under some conditions, then this indeed kind of characterizes some system with topological order. Then there was Oliver Buschhaper, who was here, I think he was here for a few years now, then generalized basically this symmetries that some called quantum doubles to twisted quantum doubles. That's kind of a more advanced version of this symmetry. And now somehow this is a special case of what I want to talk about today, these matrix product operators, which actually are actually pretty, well, it's clear that this is the right kind of language for describing this. Yes?
Can you say something like this matrix product operator value could characterize all possible topological
options? No, certainly not. If I said that, then... So they certainly classify a large class of system with topological order, namely somehow, I think, technically, this is something that is called something with Drinfield. What is the technical term, Dominic, for the system of topological order that we have, the one that have a Drinfield center? But I don't understand this. So this is Dominic. I understand somehow the matrix product operator part, and then somehow the analogous statement. Somehow you should actually have a dictionary where you have one side like the MPOs, and the other side basically all the statements in category theory, and you can really make a nice dictionary. But somehow, as far as understood, the only phases that it seems to exclude, but this is not proven, are the chiral phases. So everything that is chiral is not included in this kind of descriptions. So,
you have an example of a non-chiral that you have.
Indeed. So you have no example of a non-chiral theory that does not fit in this framework. But somehow, what is very clear is that the chiral ones do not fit in the framework. Okay. Therefore, for the chiral ones, we need something different. And actually, Ignacio and collaborators have constructed free kind of free fermion theories that are chiral in the language of PEPS. And actually, there somehow the characterization of the edge mode is also completely in terms of matrix product operators. But the problem is that they are always critical. Okay. So there doesn't, so gapped chiral phases seem to be the problem. But also somehow the matrix product operators that they use do not satisfy somehow the conditions that I will impose. They are kind of, there's some, we don't understand this yet. Okay, but it's about non-chiral topological phases. That's the topic, and it seems that indeed all these kind of phases are easily characterized by this thing. So what is one of the advantages of doing this in terms of PEPS? So first of all, somehow once we formulate something in terms of symmetries of tensors, you're not forced anymore to only think about fixed point tensors. Okay, so all these models like these string nets and things like that, they're always kind of defined as kind of only RG fixed points. And they, for example, only fit on a hexagonal lattice. And there's all these conditions that of course capture the fundamental physics, but it becomes very difficult to, for example, study questions like what happens if you perturb that system and the anions will start condensing. Okay, how do anions condense? This is actually very hard to study in the usual language in which somehow these systems have been described. If you do this in PEPS, this is actually not a problem at all. Somehow you can always perturb. So if you have a symmetry on this tensor, you can put any object that you want here, it will still have the symmetry. And this is the way you can basically kind of put some tension, and you will be able to study basically how the anions in these theories will condense, how they will kind of form maybe SET phases, all these kind of things. That's certainly one of the big motivations that we have. Another kind of very nice feature of these symmetries, once you kind of characterize the symmetries on the virtual level, because this is the physical level, but if you have symmetries on the virtual level, is that indeed Wilson loops, if you start adding a correlation length to your system, do not spread out. The Wilson loops correspond to basically the symmetries of your system, and these symmetries remain exactly symmetries of your system. So that means that if you kind of want to kind of describe Wilson loops in systems with correlation length, well, you can do that exactly. You don't have to fatten them, and this is actually a very big technical problem if you want to simulate kind of lattice gauge theories and all these kind of things in terms of Wilson loops. Okay, so this PEPS language where the symmetries are virtual, they allow you to completely circumvent these kind of things. So another motivation is actually that I wanted to understand topological quantum computation, and somehow I found this always extremely abstract. Okay, so if you look at how somehow this is, of course, one of the main reasons that people are so much excited in all these topological phases, that it kind of really will provide some way, or could provide a way of having a quantum computer that has a pretty small error rate. Okay, so it's not because you have a topological quantum computer that you will not need error correction. There's still kind of anions that will kind of go around each other, and so, but the error rate in such a system would be extremely small, and therefore it would be able to actually build somehow a scalable quantum computer with pretty less, with much less overhead. So that's one of the main motivations. And somehow I find this always extremely abstract. Okay, so if you look at how people talk about topological quantum computation, it's always because you make a pair of anions and you braid them, and then whenever you braid them, you know basically that if you will measure at the end somehow, you will do this fusion at the end. This will be the effect on this fusion because you do this, and I find it always a bit not very. It's the way this is kind of explained or kind of understood is not very compatible with the way somehow we look at quantum computation in the field of quantum information. In quantum information, we have kind of a quantum many-body state. We apply quantum gates to it, and then once the gates are applied, we just start measuring the qubits. Okay, and so the problem in this topological quantum computation is, of course, that the anions are somehow the logical dimension of somehow these anions is very, they are very weird, no? The square root of 5 plus 1 divided by 2 and all these kind of things. And it's very difficult to associate a tensor product structure to somehow your logical qubits. Okay, so where are your logical qubits? Okay, this is not clear. I mean, this was certainly not clear to me. And this is, so it's really, of course, because I don't understand all these very advanced topics. I want to understand it in this very simple language of PEPS. It turns out that indeed, if you kind of reformulate this whole topological quantum computation, and that's what I would like to end with in this talk, you will see, you can just see that the logical qubits in your kind of quantum computation are nothing more than somehow these virtual lines. But of course, you cannot see these virtual things. Okay, these are purely virtual kind of degrees of freedom that you do not see physically. Physically, you only see these ones. But somehow you can identify somehow these lines with the logical qubits on which you can just read off the standard quantum computation. And actually, if you kind of look historically back at why PEPs were introduced at all in the first place, this was actually exactly the same motivation. We want to understand how to do quantum computation with quantum many-body states. And somehow there was this cluster state quantum computation of Rausendorff and Briegel. And somehow if you look back, I don't think many people know that, but at the very first paper where somehow PEPs appear, this was exactly about how do you do quantum computation on the virtual level of a PEPs. And this, by this, we could really kind of prove the equivalence of this measurement-based quantum computation and the standard kind of quantum computation procedure. So this kind of closes the circle for me. So this is about the motivation. So this talk is not about SPT, SET, phases, gauging, symmetries, and all these kind of things. If you're interested in this, talk to Dominic. It's also not about anion condensation. Somehow this is more setting up the framework by which you can study then this, okay? So, but first you have to understand basically the symmetries to set up the symmetries, and then you can start, we can start studying how anions condense and all these things. So again, it's also not about, to kind of recuperate the question of Giffre, it's not about chiral things, okay? So we don't know, we don't understand how to kind of model chiral topological ordered systems using this language. So the main references for the work, or somehow the main inspiration, or somehow the kind of papers that are relevant to, for the work that I want to do here are mainly by, so from the tensor side are, of course, Ignacio Sirac, David Perez-Garcia, Norbert Schuch, Oliver Boerschaper, Aguado, somehow also papers of Giffre, many papers of Giffre. And then from the topological quantum ordered side, Kitaev, Wen, Levin, Gu, somehow the usual suspects. Okay, so let me now kind of give you a very rough sketch of ideas of how we can set this up. Okay, so we have a PEPS, which is this one tensor. Okay, and one of the very few things that you can prove with PEPS is the following statement, that if you kind of, this is the way you kind of put all these tensors next to each other. And you can use periodic boundary conditions or open boundary conditions. For the moment, this doesn't really matter very much. But one property that is pretty important is the property of injectivity. Okay, so what is this injectivity? It means that there exists basically a coarse graining. So that might be that you have to put these four together, or maybe have to put nine of them together. But let's ignore that for a moment. Let's just think that this one tensor is already kind of injective. And injective means that basically if you write this tensor as a matrix from this index to these four other indices, so you kind of merge all these four other indices into one big index, and this is a matrix from this index to the four other ones, that this matrix is full rank. Okay, that's basically injectivity. It's not more than that, but it has to be full rank in such a way that this dimension is larger than the product of these four dimensions on the virtual level. Okay, so that's the property of injectivity, which is actually of crucial importance both in matrix product states. This is actually this property that allowed you to prove all these SPT phases in 1D. Well, that's a two-dimensional version. What is proven is that if a tensor is injective, so basically that this has, so what it means is basically that if you trace out this particle, you would have full support on all the virtual degrees of freedom. Okay, that's somehow the meaning, that if you have a region here and I would kind of trace out all these qubits, all of them, somehow I would get an object on the virtual system, because the density matrix there, that would be full rank. That's an equivalent statement if you think about it for 2 minutes. Well, anyway, if a state is injective, then you can prove that on any kind of geometry that you put it, or any kind of, or the geometry of any genus, or on any kind of surface of any genus, that somehow the ground state is unique. Okay, therefore, unique ground state. It's actually not very hard to prove this, okay? But I'm too fast. That there exists a local Hamiltonian for which this is the unique ground state. Sorry, I should have said that. Okay, so, and if I talk, I will not really talk about Hamiltonians in this talk. So the Hamiltonians always are assumed actually to be the parent Hamiltonians of these systems. So what is a parent Hamiltonian? Because this is full rank, you can easily convince yourself that there is kind of a Hamiltonian that I can put, let's say, on these four terms, and that's typically what, this is the parent Hamiltonian of this. It's like a sum of four body terms. such that somehow this tensor lives somehow. Well, the Hamiltonian would be the null space of that system, but I don't want to kind of go too much. So people that know it, they, well, it's not really important for the case. But in the, there exists a local Hamiltonian for which is the unique ground state, and therefore this means that these systems cannot be topological ordered, okay? Because we know that if you put a system with topological order on a surface with a certain genus, somehow the degeneracy of the ground state subspace should depend on the genus of your kind of part. So that means that we have to relax that, okay? So it means that this injectivity cannot be true. We don't want injectivity. So again, somehow, in this talk, I'm only giving a very rough sketch of somehow the ideas. If you want more technical things, go to Dominic. Okay, so this is, of course, related to this kind of thing that I already said, that topological order is related to symmetries. Okay, so happens that, I need a different color, that somehow, if you have topological order, that somehow these indices, if you look at it as a quantum state, so you can of course look at these kind of things, they span some kind of a Hilbert space, these virtual indices, and you can project in any kind of thing you want. Somehow that all states living on these virtual indices, they must obey some, they must live in a subspace. Okay, that's exactly what means that if it's not injective, it means that all these kind of wave functions that you can write on the virtual level, they must obey some symmetry. Okay, namely, they must kind of live in somehow the subspace that is included in that kind of non-injective part. Okay, and what we want to do is characterize exactly this subspace using a matrix product operator. Okay, so this is, so let's kind of write this now as one big matrix product operator. Let's use periodic boundary conditions. So that's why I really need two colors here. So I have these virtual indices, and what I want to kind of claim, and of course the claim is just by example, because all known examples that we know we will be able to construct like that, turns out that somehow topological ordered systems will be characterized by saying that these kind of tensors, the symmetries of these tensors are completely characterized by matrix product operators. Okay, these are operators because somehow they map something that lives on these indices to these indices. So by matrix product operators. So these matrix product operators are actually projectors for which somehow this, let's call this P, for which P is equal to P squared. Okay, so we have some kind of a notion of a, we have a way of characterizing the symmetry of a big kind of tensor. And of course, we want this to be uniform and all of this. Okay, so we would like that, of course, if this kind of, you live on this subspace, well, you can also kind of make the subspace smaller and larger. So there should be a uniform way of defining a class of matrix product operators that basically characterize the symmetries of this tensor. Okay, and if you think about it for a minute, somehow if you have indeed a matrix product operator that kind of, well, has a projector, so it really projects you in this thing, then a natural way of defining a uniform class of such MPOs would be that if these MPOs have the following property, and we call this property the pulling through, and this is actually very central in the whole discussion, that if you have these matrix product operator tensors, or this, yeah, this matrix. So this is basically the key kind of quantity that you have to satisfy. Okay, this is basically the algebraic rule that these matrix product operators have to satisfy, such that indeed these subspaces are defined for independent kind of big systems. So, sorry, what I should have said. So why do we know that this is also a subspace? We know that you're all familiar with this kind of notion of topological quantum entropy, that if you calculate the quantum, the entanglement entropy of a certain region for a topological theory, that you have this topological correction. So you do not, you have like a leading term that scales like the area, but then you have to subtract something. Okay, you have to subtract, so the somehow the entanglement entropy of a topological order system for a certain region scales like linear in this, but then you have to subtract this gamma. And this gamma is related to the quantum dimensions of your kind of underlying theory. And this is exactly characterizing the symmetry. Okay, so there is something like a notion that's why we need this uniformity of this matrix product operator, that independent of the size, we should always get somehow the same dimension on which this thing is projected. Okay, so suppose that we indeed, for a given tensor, okay, this PEPS tensor, we find a matrix product operator. This is just one block, so this thing here is basically nothing more than this one block that I take out here. Suppose that this property is satisfied. What it means is that we can basically deform this thing. Okay, so that from instead of putting there, we can start kind of putting it like this. So it would characterize somehow basically the symmetries of this tensor network. We can basically move this thing. So if this thing is equal to itself, well, then moving this would not kind of make because of this property. And indeed, you already see that these matrix product operators would exactly be the Wilson loops. Okay, so this is actually the underlying Wilson loops of your theory. So the only other thing that you need now is that if this is satisfied, and furthermore, we have the following property, that somehow if you take two of these matrix product operators and put them like this, and this is equal to itself, then somehow this together with this is clearly a sufficient condition for somehow your tensor network to be invariant under this matrix product operator. Okay, because you can basically take any region, with these rules you can contract it to something that only lives on one edge, and if this is satisfied, then you're basically done. Okay, so this is like the algebraic rule by which you characterize the symmetry of your tensors, and we call this the pulling through condition. Okay, and furthermore, we want this to be a projector. Okay, so what you immediately see is that if I have kind of a projector with some additional properties, and I will kind of talk about these additional kind of requirements that you need, but if you have this projector, I can actually immediately construct a tensor that satisfies these rules. I can immediately construct a PEPS tensor that will correspond to this kind of topological order, and I can do this on any lattice. This is what I said, somehow once you reformulate everything in terms of PEPS, you're not restricted anymore in working on hexagonal lattices and all these kind of things. Now you can do immediately everything on any lattice you want. Namely, what is this PEPS tensor somehow that automatically would satisfy something like that? Well, it's of course the projector itself, okay? Because we know that the projector is invariant. So we will take this actually as the PEPS tensor characterizing our topological state. And then somehow this is virtual indices, and these are now the physical indices. So we interpret somehow this thing as a map from the outside to the inside. And these are the virtual ones. So these four indices correspond basically to the one physical one. And that's, you can still put anything you want here on these four indices that maps to your physical theory, but you surround that thing by this projector. And because this is a projector, somehow what you already see is that indeed, if I kind of put another one around it, well, this will not change anything, okay, because it's a projector. And somehow with these additional kind of rules, you can, so what we want to do now is basically impose these additional rules on these tensors, okay, let me erase this, on these tensors such that somehow this thing is satisfied with this. And now you see that somehow all these theories, like all these string nets, we'll see, we will just construct, for example, exact representations of such symmetries for all string nets. You can immediately put them on square lattices or any lattice that you want, okay? Because you just use as building blocks these PEPS tensors, and they will satisfy all the rules that you want. You can put them, of course, on hexagonal lattices or any lattice that you want. And you can, of course, also put now any kind of filtering operation or any kind of operator here that is not unitary, and this is exactly what will introduce a correlation length and at the end will lead to things like onion condensation. Actually, there is one extra kind of, there's actually a tiny other kind of technical constraint that we need for these tensors such that somehow we need this is our tensor, and then we need something that is called X injectivity, but that's a technical thing that I don't want to kind of talk about because it's not, I don't think it's very relevant for the talk. But with this extra condition, what you can prove is that indeed you build a lattice using such kind of tensors. Okay, so these, you have to interpret every one of these tensors is now basically this object with these, the outer indices, and these four indices, this one inner index. What you can prove then is that the ground state subspace of that whole tensor network is unique up to somehow one, well, let me put this thing in the middle somewhere. So up to one, so all ground states, if you put this, for example, a torus, let's imagine that we have a torus now. So you identify these indices with these with those. Then you can prove that all ground states are of the following form. You put these MPOs here, and here you have to put some kind of a special tensor, and it's called this tensor Q. Okay, so again, for people that are familiar with this topological order, this is not surprising at all, but nevertheless, it comes out, you can prove this in complete generality, that if you can have tensors that satisfy this, then the ground state degeneracy, all the ground states will exactly be parameterized by something that looks like this. So you just have to put two of these Wilson loops. They kind of intersect somewhere. You put some kind of a Q-tensor there, and this captures all the possible ground states of your theory. This is an operator from these indices to these indices. So if it's a projector, this is just, well, this is PSP squared. And actually, additionally, for the examples that we know, P is always equal to P dagger, but we don't know to what extent this is important.
But are you saying that it doesn't matter how many third person vectors, so that should be valid for single temporal?
Yes. Yes. But it has to be closed. You can always close this. And actually, there's some additional tiny constraint. You can put one tensor somewhere here on this thing that commutes with everything. And this is really, this is related to the quantum dimensions that you have to be careful. But this is not important. But you can indeed, for all examples that we know, this is true. So you can construct a projector such that P is equal to P squared and P is equal to P dagger that basically captures the topological order in your system. And then you construct your lattice system, your PEPs, using this. Then we know, if you do that on the torus, that all grounds are out of this form. If, of course, if you put it on a system with a different genus, well, you just it's obvious how to generalize this.
You're saying that you have all the information or that I just need to specify a single MPO.
Yeah, indeed. And at the end, all the information is just in this single object, because the PEPs itself is basically constructed from this. So all is in this. So the whole kind of way of basically classifying the phases of matter of that kind is basically classifying what are the conditions or what are the constraints on this one single tensor with four legs. Somehow that...
Well, the constraint is what you said, and now you want to find better.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so one remark, we will see this back later. So one thing that I was very confused in all these papers on topological order is like if people try to find the typical anions and all this, what they do is construct modular matrices. Okay, they correspond this somehow S and T matrices by saying, okay, I take my system and I do a Dane twist, or I kind of rotate my thing and then I close it again and I calculate overlaps of these different systems with each other. Well, I find this always very strange. How do you take a quantum spin system, rotate it, and then how do you relate this kind of new old system to the new one? Because somehow the whole lattice has been deformed. This doesn't make any sense. But it makes much more sense in the language of these MPOs. So what you do is actually the Dane twist with these MPOs. So you really want to relate somehow. You put some specific tensor Q here in the middle, and then somehow what you say, let me kind of, instead of this, let me kind of put this like this, and calculate the overlap of that wave function with the original one. And this is how you kind of construct this S and T matrices. So it's only these Dane twists or rotations and all these kind of things are only done on somehow these virtual MPOs, not on the physical system. And somehow this is exactly with using these kind of things, you of course recover all the known quantities like this S and T matrices. So this is what will come out in a more straightforward and tangible way. For the people that are lost, let me kind of give some very simple examples. Okay, so wait, how long have I been talking? Half an hour? Yeah, okay, but I am only in the second slide. Okay. Let me give some very, very simple example. So we all know, I think you're all familiar with the toric code of Kitaev. This is the Z2 gauge theory. Somehow, what is this tensor? What is this kind of MPO tensor that you would have? So what we will do is basically block. It's much simpler to kind of look at the PEPs if you block four spins together. Okay, so you have like a Hamiltonian. So let's block all these four spins, always in groups of four. And we know that somehow the ground state, if you kind of look at it from some kind of a little bit different angle, somehow what you have is x, 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 x. So this is this. You have this x, 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 x terms, and also z, 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 z terms. And the x, 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 x terms, they act somehow on the corner. So they would act here, 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 and here. Okay, so this would be, you're in a ground state of somehow this x, x, and this x is always act only on the corners. So for example, these four corners or these four corners. And this z, 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 z terms, they act on these two and these two, or these two and these two, and so further. So that's actually this is the toric code, or I think it's also called the Wen model, but I'm not too sure why this is like that. And so you want to have a ground state of these kind of things. Well, so we want to kind of see how to construct PEP stencils that satisfy this. So what you do is basically start from a wave function that is a product state of all pluses. So the plus is just the eigenstate with eigenvalue 1 of the x operator. Okay? So we start from all pluses, then automatically this is an eigenstate of all these x's. And now the only thing we want to do is basically project this onto somehow 1 plus z, 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 z for all the terms basically that tensor acting on psi. This will be the ground state, okay? Because all these terms commute with these. So if you have a ground state of this, and then you project out all these z terms, you will end up with the ground state of the Turing code. And what is this projecting on this kind of thing? Basically, what you want is that if you act with z, 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 z on these four spins, that you have an expectation value 1. So let's call this A, let's call these spins A, B, C, and D. So, and here's, for example, A prime, B prime, C prime, and D prime. This is just in the computational basis. So what I want is that there's an eigenstate of identity plus z, 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 z. So I mean that B plus D must be equal to A prime plus C prime. Okay, that's kind of an obvious statement. Okay, that's the, if this is true, then somehow it will be an eigenstate of this. So that means that actually this index here, this virtual index, must have the index B plus D. And somehow the one on the left-hand side has to match the index on the right-hand side. And that's enough to basically build your PEPs. The same thing here. This is C plus D. This is A plus C. And this is A plus B. Okay, so just always take the sum of these two, and these two. So this is, and if you have this, well, then you're sure that you have the ground state of this Z2 gauge model. And what you see now is that indeed, if you have this tensor with these properties, then somehow we have A plus C, A plus B. Every one of these numbers, A, B, C, and D, which is a 0 or a 1, appears twice. Okay, it appears once here, A appears here and here, B appears there and there, and so further. So that means that actually if we make the sum of all these numbers, it will always be even. Okay, because you have 2A plus 2B times 2C. That means that actually if you put a Z, 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 and a Z here, with somehow these, the physical indices, this must be equal to your original tensor. Okay, and this is the kind of symmetries in this very simple example of a Z2-gauge theory that we talk about. Okay, what this means is that if I put a Z here, so said differently, if I put one Z here, this is equivalent to putting a Z there, and a Z there. Okay. Okay, so this is this pulling through kind of condition. If I have a string of Zs, but in this case, this matrix product operator is completely trivial, no? The virtual bond dimension of the matrix product operator is basically, well, this thing is actually basically a G at Z. Okay, because somehow what I want here is that this is a projector. So I want the identity plus all Zs. Okay, this would be this projector, and one of these elements would be this Z, well, that I pull kind of through. So you see that this is somehow the way you construct these matrix product operators. So there's obviously two kind of these things, like I said. Okay, so you have identity, well, of course, this is the trivial one, and the Zs. So that means that identity, that this matrix product operator in that case is the identity plus Z, Z, and all Zs. This would be this matrix product operator that completely characterizes the Z2 kind of topological order. Of course, you can start perturbing now. You can put somehow another tensor here, whatever you want on top of it. And this is exactly what happens if you kind of add some perturbations, some electric or magnetic field. And this will kind of then lead to anion condensation and all these kind of things. And this you can all do in this language. And there's a, if you're interested in this, there's a paper that Jutta Hagemann recently wrote on that, which is the name of the fancy name of shadows of anions. But anyway, so this is what you do. So a more interesting and certainly for me non-trivial example is actually all the string nets of Levin and Wen. Okay, so let me kind of show that indeed somehow this pulling through condition is very natural. Okay, so let me first write down basically the tensors that, so many people actually have already kind of figured out how to write all these string nets as PEPs. This is actually, well, that it has to be a PEPs is completely obvious, okay? Because you have a Hamiltonian with all commuting terms, And then just with the same construction like this, you have to get a PEPS, okay? So this is the fact that there is a PEPS is actually obvious. The question of how to construct it is much more difficult, and somehow there were many papers where people do that. For example, Aguado, and then also Swingle, Gu, many people. I think you were also on the paper with Aguado, I guess, no? So this is... But somehow there is a PEPS way, there's a way of constructing a PEPS for all string nets, and somehow you do this on a triangular lattice, and the PEPS itself is like something like this. Okay, so you see actually all the virtual indices in the original PEPS, these white lines, are actually triples of lines, and this is very important that these are triples, and the physical indices are these ones. So you also have a triple index for the physical index. But this index somehow just runs through. If this is an A, then this is an A everywhere. If this is B, somehow you can associate something. Let me write A, B, C, I, J, K. It turns out that this is something that is called an F symbol, I, J, K, A, B, C. Okay, this is something that comes out naturally out of all this modular tensor categories, but somehow these are these F symbols that appear in Pentagon equations. For the moment, it's not important because I will show you basically what this Pentagon equation is in terms of the pulling through kind of equation. So you see, this is kind of the PEPS tensor, and you just glue these things next to each other and you get a hexagonal lattice, and this is exactly somehow the ground state of all these string net models. But what is clear is that somehow, it was not clear, but somehow, where is this colored thing? But I will construct a different tensor now because I'm not so interested in this tensor. I'm actually much more interested in these tensors that characterize the symmetries of my theory. And it turns out that you can also kind of write another tensor in the following form. You write this, 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 and then there's something here. But again, somehow this index is the same as this index is the same as this, and so further. And now you write somehow J, K, I, A, B, C. Okay, so you see again, this is like a six index object because you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 indices. It's kind of a complete rearrangement of these indices. But it turns out that this tensor indeed satisfies the pulling through with respect to this tensor, which is your kind of PEPS. Okay, and this pulling through equation, so we'll just write down basically the hexagonal equivalent of this. How do you do this? You kind of start, well, let me indeed write it on this guy. Well, let me just write it, Victoria, like this. Somehow what is interesting is that you have all these loops. So here you have two F symbols, here one and here one, okay, because you pulled this through, so you get a crossing here and there. This is the original kind of tensor, and here you have like these loops, and these loops. So basically what you see is that you get one circle here. And if you write this out, well, I'm sorry for my kind of drawing, this is exactly what is called the Pentagon equation. Okay, so for the people that have seen, have looked into string nets, this is like the crucial kind of quantities. We have like an F symbol times another F1 with lots of indices is equal to the sum over one index of three of these F symbols. Okay, and this is like the crucial quantity by which you kind of, these F symbols, if they satisfy this kind of relation, which comes out of some co-cycles, then somehow you can build a consistent math or a consistent theory of topological order out of it. And in terms of, well, maybe I should really redraw this. This is, so I have this, this, and this, this, sorry, I have to apologize. The only thing that happens is that I have to put kind of these kind of quantities. And the three tensors are 1, 2, 3. These three. Here you have two, you have 1 and 2. And somehow this inner sum here, this loop, is exactly kind of this loop that you get. So anyway, I found this very surprising somehow that indeed this pulling through equation, that is very natural if you start kind of thinking about these virtual kind of strings, these Wilson loops, well, of course, they have to be able to kind of pull them through because they should not be visible. You should not be able to see where these Wilson loops are. They have to be able to pull it through. That this is exactly equivalent to requiring that these tensors satisfy the Pentagon equation. That is exactly the consistency requirement for having a topological theory. Okay, so what this means is that actually the natural tensor for describing these Levin-Wren or these string net models in a PEPS is not these ones, but it's actually these ones. Okay, you start with kind of these, and then you put these physical things to it, and then you have a projector. Okay, and now you can define all these string net models and anything you want on any lattice that you want. For example, the square lattice, and you can also kind of start perturbing it by putting any operator that you want here, and this will allow you to understand or to study kind of condensation of these anions in these string nets. And we know that this is actually very non-trivial. Okay, there's not much understood of how Fibonacci anions kind of condense and all these things.
Sorry, Frank, I'm trying to understand this last drawing. Do you have four tensors there?
Yes, I have four tensors now.
And each of those are one?
And each of those is this one.
So you build your PEPS tensor out of four lattices?
Exactly. Or three or whatever, depending on your lattice that you want to take. But it's indeed, it's really the philosophy that everything is in this. Okay, this is the building block. We build somehow basically our tensors using this building block. Okay, so in this particular case, you can also completely work out basically, like in the string nets, what the degeneracy is, and somehow, but I will come back to this later, because somehow with this crossing tensor, the consistency relations for this Q, so where these two things cross, I can put this Q tensor, but this thing also has to satisfy the pulling through. But again, because everything that happens on this virtual level, you should not be able to see where these lines are lying, no? Because locally, you should not be able to see that there's some kind of a Wilson loop there. Locally, you should not be able to see. Therefore, somehow you should be able to kind of basically take this anywhere you want. And this Q tensor should also satisfy this. And then somehow you can very easily kind of do this now within this all these theories. So, so in principle, all these string nets somehow because of this relation, you can immediately see that all the string nets indeed fall within this framework. What we do not know is whether there's any kind of theories that are more general than string nets actually follow that fall into this framework. And for this, we have to delve deeper in somehow what it means to have modular tensor categories and all these kind of things. Okay, but somehow the main part of the talk is about anions. So what about the excitations in such a theory? Okay, because somehow the fact that these are ground state is understood, but the interesting thing is now, what are the excitations? How can we model or how can we understand anions in such theories, and how can we at the end also understand how topological quantum computation could be done and this kind of thing. So anions are somehow the elementary excitations of these models. And so we have to take a step back. Okay, we have this kind of P squared is equal to P, which characterizes basically the whole theory. It's a projector. But it turns out that this projector has some kind of internal structure that we have not discovered, and that's what we need. So we need to delve deeper, basically, in what this P is. Okay, it turns out that for all theories that have topological order, this P is actually not injective. Okay, so that means that actually, if you would look at this P in a kind of a matrix product, from a matrix product point of view, there are some kind of or blocks in this. All the tensors or the matrix product representation, if you... So, of course, you can also look at this projector as a matrix product state by just identifying these two indices as one index. No, you say, well, these two indices, there's just one doubled index, so this is just a matrix product state in that sense. And the matrices in these matrix product state, they typically have a block structure. And if they have a block structure like that, so all the matrices are like that, it means that they are not injective. That's exactly what somehow is meant. So that means that actually this P can be written down as a sum of other matrix product operators that are injective. Okay, so and now I have to kind of tell you somehow the fundamental theorem of matrix product states that actually has been found by David Perez Garcia and Ignacio Serac. Somehow many people contributed, myself included, but somehow the main somehow this is really a non-trivial theorem. That tells you that if I have two matrix product operators that are equal to each other, then they must have exactly the same canonical form. Okay, so the canonical form would exactly be basically this block diagonal form. Okay, so but of course, for people that have worked with matrix block state, this is not obvious. No, there's always some kind of a U and a U dagger. You can kind of mix these blocks. Can be completely invisible that this is indeed a matrix product operator of that form. But somehow this fundamental theorem of matrix product states really tells you that every matrix product state can be taken to a block diagonal canonical form in which each block is injective, and if a matrix product state is equal to B, then somehow that means that they have exactly the same blocks in the canonical form. Okay, this looks like a completely kind of like a theorem that doesn't seem to be very, very deep and things like that, but it has actually very deep consequences for these matrix product operators. So it basically tells you that if I have two matrix product states that are equal, then somehow in canonical form they must be equal. But let's apply this to kind of this statement. It means that if you take B squared, this is equal to sum alpha beta mu alpha w beta o alpha o beta, that is equal to sum gamma o gamma. And for the people that are very smart, and here in PI you're all very smart, you already start seeing that somehow fusion rules will kind of, that is, you will immediately get fusion rules out of this. Okay, because it tells you that if I multiply two of these matrix product operators to each other, that there will be somehow a transformation, a Gates transformation that will bring it back to the original kind of matrix product operator. So what will happen is that all these blocks in this matrix product operator label different anions. And if I take the product of two of these anions, I know for sure that I can write it again as somehow a linear combination of the original anions. Again, this is very non-trivial, but somehow this follows from this very kind of innocuous sounding kind of theorem. Tells you that if you have two matrix product states that are equal, well, that means that they have the same canonical form. Is that clear? Okay, so let's. So it turns out always that somehow for these theories to make sense, one block will always kind of correspond basically to the identity. Okay, this is like the vacuum. There's no anion in the system. Now, one block will correspond to the identity, the other blocks will kind of correspond to other anions. So, but anyway, so let's kind of write this. So what it means is that this O alpha times O beta, which is basically something that has two anions, okay? So let's kind of write this in terms of this. This would be block alpha, this would be block beta. So I take somehow, so I have these two main MPOs, no? I know that there's a way of bringing them in canonical form, so I can just take the MPO, I can just take the one block out of it, and this is this alpha and the beta. I know that this must be equal to somehow some gamma. Okay, because I know that somehow they must be included. But of course, we know that if a matrix product state is equal to another one, it only means that they are equivalent up to some Gates transform. So there must exist an operator V, and actually V tilde, such that this is equal to this. And this V will exactly be the fusion operator. Okay, it really takes anion alpha and beta and maps it to gamma somehow. And this line somehow, this line, this is really kind of the label of that line. No? So because these blocks are lying in this direction, so somehow you can label them by this orange line. This is really kind of the signature of what kind of block you have. Okay, and now you can start playing kind of the usual rules. If I know that there exists a V, this V of course depends on many variables. It depends on alpha, on beta, let's kind of write. This V depends on alpha, on beta, on gamma, but actually also to an extra index mu, because you can have multiple fusion channels and so forth and so forth. But turns out that indeed somehow the most general, from the point of view of matrix product state, this V has basically four indices. Well, it has these indices, but then it's labeled by four additional indices, alpha, beta, gamma, and some extra thing, mu. Okay, and somehow we have lots of properties now that these V's have, and all the properties of anion or somehow this the anion theories that kind of follow out of these string nets will basically be consequences of what constraints these V's have. And so you see this V, the only thing we needed for that was this fundamental theorem of matrix product states. So what kind of conditions can we put on this V? Well, first of all, we must have associativity, no? So if I know that if I combine alpha and beta and I get gamma, then if I kind of take three of them, alpha, beta, gamma, and this is equal to somehow one delta. Well, there's obviously kind of two different ways of going from the left to the right. I can first kind of fuse these two and then the product with this one, or first these two with this one, and these two things have to be equivalent. Again, up to a gauge transform. So if you kind of write this down pictorially, what it means is that if this V, if you look at this kind of V, let's turn the picture around. Basically, if I have this V like this, and I have, no, sorry, I want the other way around. If I have a V and I have the other way of kind of combining these is first fusing these two and then these two, I know that these two things must be equivalent. Okay, they must have the same effect on your kind of matrix product state. That means that there must exist some kind of a matrix, some kind of basically some gauge. Let's call this gauge F, such that this is equal to this. Okay, and if you write this down, what it means is that basically this V times V is a sum over some index, some internal index of F times V, V. It turns out that this F that comes out of here, out of consistency, will exactly be the same F that you have here. Okay, because there's some more consistency rules. You know that if there exists an F for which this is true, then you can do some more associativity. You can look at four of them. And then you know that somehow these things have to satisfy some more kind of algebraic conditions. And these algebraic conditions that this F now has to satisfy is exactly the one that we kind of derived here. Okay, so you see all of these things follow kind of very kind of simply from somehow looking at it from the point of view of matrix product states. You don't have to know anything about modular tensor categories. Now all of these things follow from this. So it happens, so you see that by looking at somehow projectors, just I have a matrix product operator that is a projector. And I know that basically this your normal form of the canonical form of a matrix product state is unique. All of these things follow immediately. And somehow from the point of view of mathematics, and this is now, I will tell you things that I don't really understand. Dominic is much better placed in that kind of thing. But it turns out that actually all of these, so from the point of view of category theory, what we are doing here is like calculating the Drinfield center of some input category. So I have some input category that will kind of be labeled by basically this F. And I have some more kind of conditions. So we'll have also somehow fusion channels. So typically what you need in, if you talk about anionic theories, you need somehow basically to know how the things can fuse. So A, B can fuse to C, or you see already had something like that, no? So if I have A and B, it can fuse to C. I need this kind of F, D, A, B, C. This is kind of these things associated to the Pentagon equation. And then there turns out to be something else, something that is called the Schur-Frobenius kind of indicator. Well, it's also something that you can immediately see that there's something conserved. With all these gauge transforms, there are things that are conserved, and this is like just a scale. This is just a sign. Somehow, if you know that this is the input, what we are calculating is basically the Drinfield center of this input category. So somehow, this means that actually we are looking at the double. We are kind of calculating some kind of a doubled version of the input category. Okay, so that means that if you start from a group and you do this kind of construction, you will end up with a doubled version of that group. And that's exactly the reason why somehow you cannot have chiral theories. Because apparently in this doubled, or in this kind of this is well known that in all these in these systems, if you calculate the Drinfield center of these kind of input categories, you will never be able to get chiral theories. Anyway, so there's actually one extra condition that we need for this pulling through. So it turns out that this is not quite enough. We need also this kind of pulling through, and this pulling through is related to something like the pivotal structure. So I'm sure that there's people here in the audience that know all of this, but there's some kind of an extra constraint that typically people put on these input categories, namely some kind of a pivotal structure. And if you have this, then you certainly also have this pulling through and all this kind of things. Okay, but let's kind of not go further with this. I would like to kind of basically understand now how the onions kind of look like. And before doing this, actually this pivotal structure that I talked about is actually an extra constraint that we have to impose on these kind of V matrices. So what we saw is that we have this constraint. Well, so actually that this is equal to this. Well, what I want is actually a stronger kind of constraint. So I want that this is equal to this. And this is related to this pivotal structure that I just talked about. This would be alpha and beta and gamma. So basically that if I have this V, I can kind of pull this thing through and I get one line and this. Okay, but this is an extra constraint. This is basically the only extra constraint that I have to impose on these matrix product operators such that they will form a consistent set of equations. So let's indeed make some simple exercise that if this is satisfied, that we immediately can kind of have this pulling through equation. Okay, so let me do this here. So I have this. This thing, and let's say I have this one string here, and I would like to pull this string through. I would kind of deform that string so that it does like this. Okay, so what I can do is make use of this. So I have this kind of guy here. So obviously I can, let me see how you do this. So I can put, instead of this, I can basically put this operator here and I can do this. And then I can take this guy and pull it through. This is exactly kind of this thing. And I can continue until I'm on the other side. And then you immediately see, well, it's just an exercise. If you're bored by my talk, you can just make the exercise. And then you see that this is equivalent to this. Okay, so it's these kind of relations immediately imply somehow the pulling through equation. Okay, so now with all this background, we are ready to talk about anions. Okay, so to see how we can start constructing anions. But I will be able to do that in 2 minutes.
All right.
So what are the anions? So I have this tensor network. Is there a tensor? Well, there's no tensor. So what I want to basically do is to let an anion end somewhere in my lattice. So I have this big lattice. And you have to think that everywhere there's also physical indices. And I want to basically have an anion that has some string attached to it. That's very clear that somehow this is the structure. And anions always come in pairs. So this one, well, there would be somehow another anion somewhere far away. So what we want to do, we want to identify basically what is this tensor here that we have to put such that we get somehow the elementary excitations in our theory. So it turns out that the natural way of doing that is to construct another matrix product operator. Somehow what we will do is kind of construct an operator that looks like this. So we'll construct this. So we need something that ends somewhere. Okay, so the only object that we have that ends somewhere is actually this V. This V kind of maps 1 to 2 indices. Okay, so let's put the V here. Okay, so there's this thing. So this is this kind of index that maps 2 to 1, but then it's kind of too trivial because I have to fuse this thing because it's round is the same as this one. So this would be that this has to be fused with itself, so it's not possible. So let's put some other V here. Okay, so we will put 2 of these Vs, and then we have a clear kind of index in the middle, and this will be the index that labels the anion. Okay, so for the moment, this is not motivated at all. No, I'm just putting whatever on that. I'm just saying, okay, let's try to understand how anions look like in my theory. And I have somehow, we just have a guess that this is the ansatz that I need. I have 2 of these V tensors and I let them end. And this kind of, I say, well, this is my object. Actually, this is very much related to work of Lam and Wen and also of Haag. Namely that somehow for anions, there is some kind of an algebraic structure. And I don't know whether Lam is here. Oh, that's you. I would love to talk to you. Somehow this is what you call a Q-algebra. It's not entirely clear how this is related to this, but somehow what you get is an operator here that again maps outer indices to inner indices. Okay, so clearly you get some kind of an algebraic structure for the anions. And this is very much related to, like I said, to this work of Lam and Wen, and also to actually Haag. Haag realized that actually if you have anions, there must be some kind of an algebraic structure underlying their properties. So indeed, somehow, this turns out to be kind of the right ansatz. Okay, so how many indices do we have here? It's clear that we have lots of indices because this is a V operator. This is another V operator. So I can kind of multiply this with any matrix, any tensor, basically A, B, C, D, mu, nu. Okay, so this would be A, this would be B, C, D, and then we know that there's some extra indices mu and nu. Okay, so you see, using these V operators, these V matrices that we got from the fusion, basically, we can construct somehow a set of operators labeled by six indices. And the reason why somehow this is very clearly the right ansatz is that somehow you can see that this forms a C star algebra. Okay, so it's an algebra, so it's kind of a, it's an operator. And if you multiply this operator with itself, so maybe, namely that somehow you take two of these operators and multiply them yourself, so you have some relation A with all these indices times another A. You can see that there's a sum over C times, again, one A. So that's why this thing forms an algebra that is actually, so it's and it's also closed under conjugation. You can also see that actually this A somehow star is equal to a superposition of somehow all these kind of guys. So it forms a complete algebra. And now it turns out that once you have an algebra, that of course you can start thinking, okay, what are the elementary objects in this algebra? And what my students tell me is that somehow the most important things in an algebra are the central idempotents. Okay. And furthermore, they kind of created a very simple MATLAB algorithm for doing this. I mean, it's not simple at all, it's very ingenious. So given somehow basically these tensors, you can take superpositions, you get an algebra, because you can just multiply it to, you get this C. And out of this C, you can basically start calculating what central idempotents is. So what is a central idempotent? These are actually some kind of the objects for which Pi times Pj is equal to delta ij times Pi. And furthermore, all these, so these P's are just linear combinations of these guys. And somehow, furthermore, these P's kind of commute with all the other elements in your kind of theory. Okay, so basically you want to have a resolution of the identity of your kind of thing. So basically this, you have an algebra, and it turns out that the elementary anions, all the anions in your theory, can be constructed as linear combinations of such objects. And furthermore, you require that they basically, that these objects satisfy some orthogonality constraints. Okay, you just construct basically the elementary projectors out of such things, and all these kind of elementary, kind of these central idempotents will exactly correspond to the somehow the anions in your theory. Okay, so and it's very easy. So once you have this, well, you can start kind of looking at lots of interesting stuff. And this is now what I want to convince you of is that. So the first thing you do is, so this is at the end, this is just a simple MATLAB program. You get this out. Let's calculate somehow the topological spin of such an anion. Okay, just to make some kind of a simple game. Okay, so we have this anion. It ends somewhere. So we have this kind of quantity here. So what is the spin of an anion? It's really, if you do a rotation over 360 degrees, you want to kind of relate, you want to see what phase that you got. Well, what does that mean from this point of view? You just take this string and wind it around this kind of thing and say, ah, I want to express this as a linear combination of my central idempotents. And what you see is that indeed you can do that, and you just get that this is equal to e to the I phi times the original thing. Okay, this. Okay, and this is immediately, so you can immediately associate some kind of a spin to your kind of anion. What is much more relevant is actually the braiding. Okay, so what is braiding? Well, I have one of these anions. And I want to do braiding. So basically, I have some other kind of, let's say, Wilson loop somewhere. And I want to basically kind of pull this. So I know that there is another Wilson loop from some other anion there. And what I want is basically to know what happens if I would pull this kind of thing through. So what you only have to identify basically what this thing is. So you have to take a linear combination of this and this, and you have to put some kind of an operator here. And you can just work out this inequality. This has to be equal to this. Therefore, this object has to be something. It turns out that this object itself is nothing more than the original kind of operator that you get in this kind of well, this thing that you get here is nothing more than this object itself, which indeed has four indices. Okay, and the way I can explain this, but it seems that there's not too much time left, I would be happy to kind of show you that indeed somehow, once you have this knowledge, you can immediately deduce what this braiding tensor has to be. Okay, so if I have an onion there, I want this to be equal to this. Well, there is, you know exactly what this is, and you can express this in terms of these original kind of tensors. So basically this V, and then there's another V. So this is basically what this tensor will exactly be, something like this, where you, of course, have to reroute the indices. You see I have four indices. But you can immediately construct this. So so what is fusion? Well, fusion is basically I have two onions in my theory. I have somewhere an onion, and I have somewhere another onion. And you would like to measure what is the kind of, and if I would measure somehow the onion, to what kind of onions can they fuse? Okay, well, what can you fuse? So what you have to do is basically put this matrix product operator, of course, there's not limited to act on one side. You can act, there's many of these indices lying around here. You can just put this whole thing around. Again, these things could be fused by this V, and then somehow you would have this tensor here, which would be this braiding tensor. And somehow this thing doing a measurement here would exactly correspond to fusion. So I'm going a bit fast, but I hope that this is, well, that is a bit clear somehow. And in the last minute, what I want to show now is that indeed this topological quantum computation can be understood in terms of these virtual indices. Okay, so we have 1 more minute. So let's... Okay, so what happens, how does topological quantum computation work? So let's do it with string nets. Okay, the simplest example of a topological kind of universal quantum, topological quantum computer you can build is actually the Fibonacci model. Okay, this is actually the simplest string net that has a non-trivial kind of fusion rules. Namely, it has two particles, tau times tau is equal to 1 plus tau. And somehow, these peps that you construct out of this input fusion category is actually the doubled model. So what you will get is actually not just tau, you will get a 1, you get a tau, we get a tau bar, and then a tau bar. And you can see that actually these four particles are indeed the solutions of somehow, these are the central idempotents of this algebra that you construct by starting from the string net. So you have this string net, we know all the solutions, you construct this kind of algebra, you calculate the idempotents, and you see that there's four central idempotents corresponding to somehow the elementary particles in your system. But for topological quantum computation, actually, we only need one of them. Okay, so we take one of them, and somehow what we have is this big tensor network. Okay, so we have this tensor network, this PEPS, and what we will interpret this, we will interpret time basically as the vertical direction. So what happens is that I create kind of an onion anti-onion pair, another one, and what I want to do now is basically braid these things with each other. Okay, so I have this, and I want to braid this, and to do this. And then at the endpoints here, of course, this is where my onions are. Okay, so let's see. This is basically how you can understand topological quantum computation. You make pairs. You kind of drag these things around. You move them around each other or above each other. But we know exactly what this means in terms of these PEPs. So every time we have a crossing, we kind of basically have to put one of these tensors here. Okay, these tensors. It turns out that these braiding tensors are exactly somehow these Q tensors that we talked about. So it means that all these objects that we have here, we can basically pull them through. Okay, so we can pull them through the lattice to one plaquette. Okay, so let's take one plaquette. And all this kind of braiding, we can just say, well, it goes on just in this one plaquette. So I would have in this particular case something like this, this, and then I have, well, whatever, it doesn't really matter what I do. Okay, and then something like this. Now, as I showed in this string nets, what you have is always triple indices. So you have like an, so there's always loops everywhere. And there's one big loop here around it. And you see every time there's a crossing, I have to put this braiding tensor. And now somehow it turns out that these extra loops, which are kind of completely invisible, contain all the logical information of your quantum computation. So whenever you kind of do a braiding, it's like you have a tree. So what you have here is three of these white things. You have a gate, and then you have again three of these white things. So you will just have to look at this from this point of view. I have some kind of a qubit here, there, and there. And this is like mapping this qubit to that qubit. And if you work this out carefully, what you see is that this gate is nothing more than somehow a controlled, controlled gate, controlled, controlled phase gate. Okay, somehow this is the central qubit. Let's call this A, B, and C. This is A, B, and C. So what this gate does is basically map this qubit to that qubit, controlled on whether these kind of anions are both kind of, controlled on these white indices of these kind of labels. It turns out that these, in this case of Fibonacci anions, are indeed exactly qubits. It turns out that this is exactly a unitary transformation. So it's kind of a controlled, controlled unity transformation that is not actually very easy. It's like this. It has some very weird phases. It has all these Fibonacci type of phases. And indeed, it's well known in quantum information theory that if you have a gate with three qubits with this controlled, controlled something, that this is typically universal. In this case, this is exactly universal. And indeed, you can just read off the quantum circuit. So that means that indeed, the logical information, the logical qubits of your topological quantum information are nothing more than these kind of virtual indices of your kind of PEPs. And somehow, if you braid, this is doing nothing more than a unity transformation on these kind of things. And at the end, you just read out the results, and you recover the standard scheme of kind of quantum computation. And I have to stop here. Thanks. Thanks for your attention.
So in this picture, you're saying that, let's see, first we associate lines, the orange lines are
always these guys.
Right, right. But in this drawing, you have some evolution in terms of anion, and those lines will end up being the gate.
Yes.
Or the crossings of those
lines. The crossings of these lines will kind of... So these lines, the orange lines themselves always contain three lines. So actually these... like. So there's actually always, well... there's always threefold kind of thing. Okay, and the middle index is actually completely fixed, and it's the outer indices... well, that's completely unobservable. That actually the logical, they contain the logical information. They are the logical qubits.
You're going to map the outer lines, these white lines, into qubits, and the orange line will become the gate.
No, the orange line is actually, in this particular case, is always one. So the orange line is nothing, but somehow the gate, of course, acts on. The gate acts on the white guys.
There will be one gate pair.
But every time you have a crossing, you have a gate. And it just turns out that indeed in this topological quantum computation, well, the gate that you get just turns out you only have one gate, but it's known that if you have a controlled, controlled, whatever gate in a normal quantum circuit, that this is generically kind of universal.
You have an explicit translator in blue, anionic evolution and a quantum circuit.
Yep.
Where you see where the qubits are.
Indeed, you just read off the qubits, and indeed, somehow the fact that the quantum dimension of these qubits, so they always say the quantum dimensions of like these anions, like these Fibonacci anions are square root of 5 plus 1 divided by 2. So what does that mean? It actually means that you will only kind of, with such gates, you can see that you will never be able to, you will not be able to occupy more than a fraction, 1 plus square root of 2, 1 plus square root of 5 divided by 2 to the n of all the possible kind of states in that Hilbert space. And it's because somehow this prevents, there's just some consistency relation.
Is that a statement about the hat space?
Yes. It's just that these gates can only occupy so many states. So it just prevents basically to have these three qubits cannot be tau one and one. This is not allowed. Okay, if there's one tau, there must be two taus. That's basically the Fibonacci kind of. Well, that's called Fibonacci, and that's exactly because there's some kind of constraints. And gates like that, the gates that you get, indeed, if you start with some state that satisfies this rule that the tau is never, what is it actually? If you have a middle tau, it has to be, there must at least be one tau around it. That's basically what are the rules I basically. Indeed. And that's why this quantum dimension is just well related to the fact that indeed you cannot explore the full Hilbert space. But that doesn't matter. It's still rich enough. It's still big enough to do universal quantum computation. Yes?
One other thing, so if you try to generalize this to, like, say, 3D, and you can imagine classifying phases in
Well, you have to ask Dominic. Dominic is exactly doing this. He's working on three-dimensional versions of these kind of things. And but of course, everything is much more complicated. There's not so there's no canonical. So all of this at the end crucially dependent on this canonical form of matrix product states. Okay, the fact that if I have two matrix product states that are equal, then I know that they are the same, that they have the same canonical form. That's basically the whole. That's the basis of the whole kind of thing. And in two dimensions, we don't have anything like that. And that's, of course, it might be that somehow for this subclass that is interesting, these properties are there, but they're certainly not, we will not be able to build such a general framework there. But indeed, it's a very interesting question. And,
So, yeah,
thank you.
Thank you. There are no more questions. Thanks a lot for the talk.